This is Dave Fletcher, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 25th of April, 2012. Dave Fletcher, Part 2.
How did the transfer to Sydney come about?
Essentially, as I say, my original contract was 2 years at Halley. Then the Shackleton programme fell through. So obviously, at that time in the office, they decided to take the dogs out, the remaining dogs at Halley, and take them round to Stonington. But there was really no position for me at Stonington, because they'd already fully. But then I was asked if I would be prepared to become base commander at Sydney. So we brought the dogs out on the Bransfield with myself and John Newman, and then we stopped at Sydney on the way where I got off, and then the rest of the dogs went round to Stonington, basically.
And how different was it at Sydney?
Oh, hugely different. I mean, obviously, topographically, completely different, you know, from far south of Weddell Sea to this offshore island, really. And going from a purely physical base, really, geophysical base at Halley, we're now on a purely biological base at Sydney. So there were many, many differences. Fortunately, I knew many of the lads at Sydney because I'd come south with them, so it wasn't as if it was a completely new experience. I'd seen Sydney on the way down to Halley the year before, so I knew what it looked like, but that was about it, really. I was sort of, if you like, thrust in at the deep end, and I took over from Mike Richardson, who, of course, became FCO polar man for many years, and just only retired a few years ago.
So. Yeah, I'm seeing him in Devon.
All right.
So were you base commander from the beginning?
Yes, I was, yeah.
Were you surprised at the appointment?
Yes, I was, really. I was explained that, you know, that they would like me to do it, A, because I said, like, there's a GA background. They felt that that would be a good input on the health and safety. There'd been a few incidents over the years before at Sydney, which they felt was a bit of a concern. And also, of course, I had, you know, my biological background, if you like, you know, was of some help as well. But that was it, basically, and I did actually... I did find it a bit of a challenge, to say the least, a bit of a worry.
What were the biggest problems?
Well, there were no real problems at all. I was very conscious of the fact that I was an outsider being pushed into position at Sydney in a completely out of the norm. They'd always had a senior scientist had been base commander for a winter and then gone on. That had been the tradition. And now suddenly there was this outsider thrust upon them, as it were. So I was very careful at the start to tread carefully and just, you know, not, if you like, impose my will on it. And if there were going to be changes that I felt should be made, then I would do them. But I just felt that I should do them very slowly. So I was conscious of going into a new place, as it were.
So did you actually witness or perceive skepticism amongst the ranks, or were you just worried there might be?
I was worried there might be, and I think there was.
Initially.
Somebody thrust from the outside, why are you here, type of thing. I mean, some of the questions when I arrive were, what project are you going to be doing and why are you here? You know, as if there was some grand scheme. Well, as far as I was aware, there was no grand scheme at all. I mean, I was just, you know, going in.
How do you bring them round?
I think by being quiet, really. I think by just fitting into the system. I tried to understand, because obviously there was a handover between Mike and me, and I tried to learn as much about the base as I could and get involved in all sorts of things before I was officially took over, as it were. There was at that time also I perceived there were things I would want to change fairly quickly.
Well,
there was no night watch at the time, and having come from Halley, where night watch was a very important thing, I just felt that was, you know, that needed changing and we needed a night watch. I also felt they obviously went off individually to do their scientific programs all over the island. I felt there needed to be some more control on that. And I
you mean one person on his own?
Yeah, I instigated a time system and a book system where people had to check out and had to be back at a certain time. You know, so we had some sort of control of what was going on. And as I say, I instilled a night watch.
Was there resistance to those ideas?
None at all, actually. The night watch, I think they'd all wanted to do one, but had not really... And in fact, funnily enough, the bloke in that photograph you've given me, Jan Ugersteger, was also instrumental because he was sort of, he had the sort of fire chief hat, if you like, and he was very concerned that that wasn't really good. So together we, so there was all sorts of help there. And
So there was not really any concerted resistance to what you might call professionalism?
No.
In fact, do you think they were? You rather hinted that perhaps they were actually rather hoping it might come.
Yeah, I that was certainly the feeling I got with the fire watch and fire. The night watch and fire, that they thought it was something they should do, but had never really, if the situation had developed to do it, and also on the field thing because it wasn't a major change, it didn't stop them doing what they were doing. I just got them to sign a book, and do it. On a much more formal basis.
So you knew where they were.
So we knew exactly where they were because we were just at that stage in history, we were sort of playing around with the handheld radios, which were frankly ineffective after 50 metres. So, you know, that was a nonsense carrying those things around. So we needed something. And what we did install, and in fact I did it twice very soon afterwards, if people were late, I immediately organised a search party. Okay, I knew they were probably weren't a problem, but just to integrate the system. And it really became, you know, and we did things, as I say, started doing things like a stretcher lower and practices. And, you know, I just thought things that we should be doing, really.
Were there many false alarms about overdue science stuff?
No, I only ever had, I did one in the first few months. And then I never had another one for 5 years, I don't think. So, no, it wasn't.
Paint me a little thumbnail sketch of Cygni as it was in 71.
Very basic.
72. 72.
Well, when I first got there, and of course my first year was before the huge rebuild that went on, which went on all the bases, actually. But when I got there, there was essentially, there was just this strange plastic hut thing. Which was, there was another one, of course, at Deception, and the old original base hut, really. It was a biological station, pure and simply. Everybody was involved in biology. And, of course, also, which again was something I hadn't experienced, it was a diving station, which again was a worry. I found a worry to start with because, you know, lads were diving every day and in a difficult, in cold, hostile water, leopard seals, all sorts of things. But that side, Paul Skillin was there then, and a chap called Howard Bissell. The diving officers really organised that brilliantly, and that was superb. But it was something that I was concerned about because it was something I didn't understand.
Had you been diving?
I had dived, pleasure dived in the UK, but one of the first things I did was learn to dive down there. So I was able to go out on a lot of the dives. And then, as I say, I also took time to go out with the people to learn their jobs. But the base was very small. I mean, there was only, in that first summer, there was only about 25 of us, and then down to 16 in the winter. And I actually managed to talk Bass offices into letting the builder, the Chippy, winter, because I knew the next summer was going to be an enormous building programme, and just felt that it would be good that we had, you know, him down there to have a winter before we started on this. So that was looking to the future. But it was a very small, close-knit station. Excellent sort of morale. And Cygni is a... Though you at first thought, you know, you think it's a bit like a Faraday, a very small place where you can't go anywhere. Cygni you can, of course. It's 5x3, the island. There's lots of things like skiing and walking. And, of course, in the summer, oodles of wildlife. So there's lots to do. And they'd had a couple of years there, two of their coldest years they ever had, and excellent sea ice. We had sea ice for like 7 months of the year. So we were able to get on the sea ice. We did trips and so I encouraged expeditions, if you like, over to Coronation Island. Not too sure that Ted Clapper fully agreed with it in Stanley, but we only let him know what we needed to know, need to know basis. So yeah, it was a very small, knit, excellent, very nice station. Yeah, lovely.
There's a base report here from 1973, which suggests that going to Coronation Island wasn't quite as easy as you might have thought it was.
No, definitely not.
Tell me a bit about that experience.
It's a real challenge. I mean, the weather at Signy is appalling, to be quite honest. I mean, during the summer, the weather is totally appalling. And during the winter as well, you get these huge storms come through. And of course, the sea ice is, you know, between Signy, it's 5 miles to Coronation, is not always guaranteed. We'd done a lot of sea ice expeditions, but going up onto the island is it's a challenge, you know. And some of them were, oh, we'll do this, we'll do that. And I said, well, if you do, I'll come. And I'm glad I did, because the place is riddled in crevasses. It's just, you know, just ice falls, basically. And it's, you know, it's a serious undertaking, basically. And also, I say you're constantly battered by monster winds. You know,
how do you go about? Presumably, as base commander, you had to sanction all these trips.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
How do you go about making that decision?
Well, what I did basically was anything that was along the sea ice, along the coast, was fine, because that's what the lads did day in and day out around the island and so on. So they were well aware of sea ice conditions. Obviously made sure we went right through what gear they were taking and what provisions they were going to do and backup and so on. But if anybody wanted to go actually up on Coronation, then I went with them. I'm glad I did, because there was a couple of real close shaves.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, we did one. There was one, well, they originally wanted to go right down the island, and I didn't really think it was possible, but said, look, I'll come with you. Let's see what it's like. And we got We actually didn't go very far, but we went across one of the glaciers, which was fine, then up over a place called Echo Pass, and then got involved in these huge ice falls. And we were getting, I mean, we had one, the back of the sledge was sort of over one bridge of a crevasse. We were on the other bridge of a crevasse. That's it, you know, we'd camp and then we'd turn around. And we got back to the glacier again, monster winds. So I told the lads, right, we'll dig a snow hole under the tent, because this tent's going to go soon. It didn't, as it turned out. But others that were on another trip, their tents did get blown away. You get these huge hammer blow winds, 100 knot plus, is coming off the tops, and it is a difficult place. But so we always tried to have it under control, as it were. But we did, you know, we practiced and we did vet these things as much as we possibly could. And I just felt, all right, it's blowing my own trumpet. I just felt these were the sort of trips that had happened in years gone by, which had been a shambles. But at least we got them under control and had some, you know, some
better overview. Better prepared.
Yeah, we had some overview of what was going on.
But you were still sanctioning trips for leisure?
Yes, these were pure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was one of the things that I, you know, because I became quite sympathetic with Faraday later on, because, you know, you're stuck on this little blob in the ocean in the most fantastic scenery, but unable to go anywhere. At least Signy, we could go somewhere. And at that time in history, of course, there were also scientific programs being done on Coronation, because there was a small hut being built over there called Shingle. So there were connections with Coronation, if you like. And I just felt, you know, these leisure trips would sort of help, again, safety, because, you know, people would understand the problems, if you like, you know, what they were putting themselves in for.
Some of the diving was for pleasure as well, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, a lot of the diving was for pleasure. But I say pleasure, a lot of the diving was for pleasure, stroke training. One of the things we tried to encourage was everybody on the base dived, whatever they were, mechanic, carpenter, whatever, because they then became aware of the effort that was required. If we had a dive in the winter when there was only 16 of us, basically the whole base was involved. We had people driving the skidoo, we had people cutting the hole, we had people looking after the bath, we had people standing by on the decompression chamber. You know, the whole base was involved. And if you had to get the whole base involved, you had to give them a feel of why they were involved. And we felt if we offered this diving pleasure-wise, then at least they would understand the problems, you know, a diver faced, basically. And it was quite successful, really, to do that, you know, because it really was. There were so many things at Signy, the only way to do it was to get the whole base involved. The base was too small. to try and do it any other way. So you needed a team, and that's the way we felt we did it.
There's a program of sub aqua photography going on. Was that something you were aware of?
Yes, it was Brian Kellett. Yeah, there was several bits, and again, you know, the Brian one, I was partially involved in that because I felt it was a way he should go forward. Really, we're doing his work on worms. He was working on, and photography really, of course, was in his infancy then. There was really not that many, if you like, underwater cameras. I mean, it was all pretty much an epic, and you know, ektachrome films were developed by hanging them down the corridors and things like that. It was all pretty basic stuff. And of course, it moved on considerably when Doug Allen came there later, and you know, it's a few years later. There was a very early stage of lot of development programs, really, and photography particularly, which of course developed hugely as the years went on.
Reminds me of Hans and Lottie Haas, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But you would see there were these photographers were actually going under the ice.
Oh yeah, yeah, we dived under the ice virtually the whole of the winter. Yeah,
and were they coming up with anything unusual?
As far as finds are concerned,
yeah, either.
Oh yeah, I mean there was new species found almost daily. I mean, yeah,
really?
Yeah. I mean, again, not that we were totally aware of it at Cygni, because these all obviously went back to Bass and then worked up there. But there was also a thing being gone on in the summer called the South Orkney Benthic Survey, which was the BISCO, the ship was doing trawling, and they found things that we had no idea about, really. You know, coral fields and things like that, which we had no idea about. And of course, we were finding them around Cygni, but it really was, you know, and again, obviously it's come into play in recent years with the death of Kirsty at Rotherham. I mean, we had leopard seal contacts virtually every day in the summer.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
So were there any close calls?
A few. I mean, me and Gordon Picken had one. But again, it's like the Kirsty thing. You see, I'm not convinced the leopard seal attacks. I think the leopard seal is inquisitive because it's top predator. It wants to know what's going on. I mean, in my daily job now, I have zodiacs bitten by leopard seals when we have tourists on board. But I'm sure it's not an attack. I think they come in, and their only way of finding out is to feel with their teeth. And they feel with the teeth, and whatever they're feeling suddenly moves off. That inquisitive becomes attack within a millisecond. And it was the same when we're underwater with them. They want to know what you are. They come and push you with their nose. And you basically lay, you just hang there in the water. Okay, you draw your knife, but I mean, that's frankly, it's more for your own benefit than them. But you do feel frightened. There's no two ways. I mean, big creatures, 12 foot of leopard seal pushing you in the back is, you know, and they'll swim around you. But they're just trying to find out what you are. But I'm certain if you made a sudden movement at that time, then that inquisitiveness would become attack. And I have a feeling that's what happened with Kirsty. You know, the leopard seal was probably, because she was snorkeling, she wasn't diving. And I just had a feeling that suddenly inquisitiveness became attack. I don't think that, I mean, I may totally be wrong, but I don't think the seal went out to attack Kirsty. I think she was in it, and she may have been, you know, in a position where the animal was interested, and then suddenly the movement, whatever, grabbed her and took her down and drowned her, of course. Mm-hmm. And it happened with us several times, not on the attack side, but you just got this feeling that, you know, they were tolerating you, if you like. They were trying to find out what you were. And you just have that feeling that if you did something wrong, things would change.
Yeah. Just for the record, Kirsty is Kirsty Brown.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, after Kirsty Brown's death, there was a procedure installed at Rotherham of having somebody on watch.
Yeah.
Did you have people on watch?
No. We never actually, through naivety probably or whatever, we never considered leopard seals a problem. I mean, we had them virtually every dive. They would turn up because obviously, again, they would hear movement in the water. Mm. You know, what are you doing? You know, and most of the time they would just disappear. But occasionally you had some more that would come a little bit closer. But we never considered them a real problem. I mean, we had sort of, I mean, again, before my time, and I think quite a long time before my time, there'd been a few schools of orcas, of killer whales, had turned up. I never had a pod there, but again, there was apparently the boatman would carry a gun in the boat. Well, that just, the whole thought of that just terrified me. I could imagine some bloke blazing away And it often occurred to me that in a black wetsuit, you look suspiciously like the back of a seal or a whale. So we abandoned that one straight away. The only thing we used to take occasionally in the summer times was crackers, like big fireworks, if you like, drop in the water, boom. And of course, again, we're top predators. You benefit because they're not frightened, but they want to know what that noise is, and will tend to back off and assess what's going on. And it's a similar thing like a polar bear. You know, you have that gap, well, because the animal's intelligent, of trying to work out what's going on, and in that gap you get out, basically, or you move off or whatever. You know, but with the leopard seals, we never had a problem with them.
Yeah. There was no doctor at Signy at your time?
No.
Was that something that concerned you?
Yeah, because it was me that had to take teeth out and things like that. Yeah, yes, it did. I mean, what concerned me most of all, and which of course changed in years, was the diving aspect again. Mm. You know, if we'd had a decompression situation, it would have been serious, because we only had a single decompression chamber, which was a nightmare. Just to, you know, you put this person in this single chamber and sent them down for 24 hours or something, and nothing we could do about it. But again, from Halley and things, you know, we had a doctor at Halley, but we'd all stitched each other up. We'd all minor things, and I had to take a couple of people's teeth out and things like that. And it's all a bit of a daunting when you got Curafid, which is a book, in one hand, and you're sort of wrenching away. And it's a challenge, put it that way. But it was the diving side that particularly worried me.
In your base report in 1973, you said that if it's not possible for there to be a doctor, it should be possible for the new BC to attend some medical courses.
Mm, yeah.
And particularly to become familiar with the commoner drugs and their uses, and the techniques laid out in Curafid.
Yeah. It was, I suppose if you could say, my background, a mountaineer and anything, I dealt with many of these problems, you know, like cuts and bruises and breaks. Wasn't a problem. It was again the drug side. It was the doctor, the diagnostic bit, yeah, that I didn't feel comfortable with. You know, again, the practical side you can deal with.
You were also concerned about the state of the teeth of people coming down to the Antarctic.
In fact, the year after, we had a dentist on the ships. Yes, I was. I mean, two teeth I took out, and I filled five or six, which I'm sure just fell out straight away. But yeah, the state of the teeth I was concerned with. In fact, the two I took out, which is actually Don Goddard, who's dead suddenly, he'd broken the tops off a winch handle and smacked him in the mouth. And I'm sure they didn't need to come out, but the dentist back in Stanley, I think it was Stanley, they have to come out. But I'm sure in a more modern era, with a dentist available on the radio type of thing, I'm sure they could have been saved, I mean, I was more concerned with breaking Don's jaw than I was getting the teeth out. It's because they were perfectly good teeth, except if it broken in half. And it was that concerned me a good deal.
So did Bass pay any attention to your recommendation?
I think so. I'd say the dentist appeared not long after. Yeah. I think, and also, to be fair, it wasn't just me. I think people had become, were becoming aware that this was a situation, particularly with diving, that we had a decompression chamber. Okay, we knew we had the manual. We really didn't have much input. Mm-hmm. And all right, we weren't diving deep, but I mean, we did have a few summer dives around sort of 90 feet. And you're on decompression times then. And when you're working, and when you've got animals around, where you may have to come up quickly, there were all sorts of implications, if you like. And I actually talked to Ricky about it a lot, because, and the trouble with doctors was, sounds awful, but the trouble with a doctor is that basically 99% of the time you can put them in a drawer and you don't need them. But then when you do need them, of course, and this is the problem, I think this was the problem Bass had as far as a recruitment policy was concerned. You essentially had a useless bloke. Not useless, but you know what I mean. Essentially,
spare.
And many of the bases simply couldn't carry that.
Yeah.
And I mean, one at Halley we had, he did mainly cold research and things. So he had a program, if you like. But many of them, I think, was the felt that, well, they haven't got a program, they're not going to be of any use. But I mean, if we'd have had an accident diving out, we'd have been crucified. We really would. But then
it was that addressed later on?
It was. We got a two man. 2-man decompression chamber, which of course was a massive difference. And we had a doctor, and of course that was addressed.
From when? Was that during your time?
No, sadly, no. Everything after I left, really. No, it was something we had to have, you know.
The other thing that was coming in at that time was pollution management.
Yeah.
The Bass was becoming environmentally aware,
shall
we say. And did that raise interesting issues for you?
It did. I mean, particularly at Sydney. Again, because very small base, very small area, also a very strong photographic base. And we'd already, or not me, but, you know, earlier scientists already noticed the implications of photographic chemicals going in the cove, and the cove being a totally different world to what was outside of the cove, you know, literally maybe 500 metres away. So that was already in the mind. And we'd already tried to flatten tin cans. We're still dropping them in the sea, but we were trying to burn the cans, break them down. You know, there was efforts already starting. We did, and I must admit, okay, I'll just say, it says I, but I mean, I instigated base walks where we'd sweep the base. I did it at Rotherham, picking everything up all the way, you know, try and keep the place clean. I remember having a huge argument with Bass Office at that time, when I first went to Rotherham, about taking fuel drums back. And no, you leave them down there. We can't cope with them being brought back. And it was something that really actually did worry me, because we were, well, Halley, what did we use at Halley? 3,000 drums a year. And at Rotherham, even more with the aircraft fuels. And we were just dumping them out in the ocean. And I just couldn't see the point on why we couldn't take them back to the UK. Which, again, happened eventually. But it did take an awfully long time.
So that sounds like there was a resistance to your proposal.
There was. And I think the resistance was that it was difficult to get them in, paperwork-wise. And, you know, I mean, I think that's all it was. I can't think of any other reason. Because, I mean, all the drums had it stamped, £5 on returns. I mean, you know. But I think it was just a purely logistics thing, yeah, and complications. I don't know, but complications at this end.
So how did you solve the photographic chemicals? They used...
We tanked it. We put everything in a 5-gallon, you know, we began to, and then send that back, and that was accepted. But, yeah, so, again, people had already become aware of these sort of things happening and, you know, changes in the, you know, in the biology and so on. So it was already underway, and we did try to keep the place clean, and we did start to, you know, become more aware, as it were. And things like over the island... We were also aware that there were hundreds of stakes from previous experiments, and, you know, clear those sort of things up. So there was a beginning of an awareness, yeah.
Let's move on, if you may, to your decision to, or the decision, it may not have been yours, to stop going to Halley. This would be at the end of 79. Why did that change take place?
Stop going to Sydney.
Sydney, I beg your pardon.
Then to Rotherham. Then to Rotherham, yeah. Well, Rotherham in 76, 77, I went to Rotherham.
76, 77?
Yeah.
So how many years were you at Sydney then?
I was at Sydney for five years, but basically one winter and four summers.
Right.
So and then I was asked if I would... Steve Wormald had retired... And the year before, and then Rotherham was being built, and they would ask me if I would go in and commission Rotherham, if you like.
Oh, you were there at the very beginning?
Yeah, right at the start. Yeah.
So you were the first base commander at...
No, technically the second, because Steve was still base commander when he was doing Adelaide and Rotherham.
Right.
But I was the first complete Rotherham. Yeah, so I was the first base commander, basically.
Tell me about that process of commissioning a new base.
Yeah. Difficult. That was a difficult transition, actually, because when I went to Rotherham, it not have been a good winter. There was a definite division. Steve used to really drive people on, which half the base thought was great, but half thought it was a nightmare. They'd been left an awful lot to do during the winter to, you know, if you like, bring the base up ready for the first summer. And when I got there, there was a real anti-feeling. You know, but there was a split between, oh, you know, rev, 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 and, or, you know, in other words, go, 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 and, you know, others, less back off or whatever. So it was a difficult summer. Challenge. I'm not entirely sure I liked my first summer, because I really got to love Signy very much, and because I liked the freedom at Signy. There was so much to do and so much. Whereas Rotherham, I was basically flying a desk essentially. Mm. But I did manage to. I did like do quite a lot with the aircraft, because again, I was not really happy the way depots were being laid and things like that. So I got involved on the field side of it. But that first summer was difficult, because say there was a split on the base, trying to get a new base running. We had a terrible weather season for weather, so often the scientists were sitting on the base waiting to go out somewhere. And at the end of the season, of course, we had a complete epic. We left two scientists behind at Belgrano. We couldn't pick them up because one aircraft had crashed, the other pilot wouldn't fly out on his own, which I can totally understand. And so we ended up leaving two lads behind at Belgrano. So the whole three lads, sorry, not two, yeah, three. So the whole thing was, you know, very difficult. But it was okay, because the positive side is that we got people thinking my way, and we began to get a bit more of a sort of different regime established. And again, it's always difficult going on a new base. You know, basically had taken over from Adelaide. That was the regime it had been going for, whatever, 20 years. So we needed to establish a new regime. We needed to establish a new way of dealing with people. We needed to change the personnel as well. I was having big battles with the office. The office wanted to take out all the Met men. I said, we can't have an air base without a Met man. You know, this doesn't work. So, you know, there were all sorts of these conflicts going on, as well as, I say, you know, dropping an aircraft and having people stuck over at Belgrano. We were stretched to be, I mean, you know, in retrospect, we really shouldn't have had all these programs going at the same time as we were trying to commission the base. But like everything, we get through. So it was a difficult summer. But to cap it off after awful weather, we then had incredibly cold weather at the end, so the ship was stuck in ice, and so we had half the base thinking they were never going to get out and learn it. Yeah, interesting.
This was also going to be Bassi's jewel in the crown, yeah, wasn't yeah. it? So was the perhaps the extra pressure of becoming a showcase base?
It was. There was no doubt about that. You know, this was going to be Rotherham, and this is, you know, and. But again, I just got the feeling that, and this is no criticism of Steve, but I just don't think he'd been given the chance to. It needed a couple of seasons to work it in, basically. Mm. And suddenly Adelaide became Rotherham. End of story. And base wasn't finished, and, you know, there was all sorts of things. It, and I say the base morale wasn't great there. And just my little thing. I remember the first day I was there. And I looked out the window, I thought, where's the flag? And there was no flag flying or anything like that. There were little things like that, which we did, and we changed it, and we got the sort of people thinking about it. And it was, in the end, we had quite a successful season, and of course, then followed for the second season, which was hugely successful. You know, so we did actually manage to get it running, if you like.
The lack of flag suggests a lack of pride.
Yeah. That's exactly how I felt when I went in the station.
Turning that round. What were your tactics for turning that round?
Well, trying to talk to everybody, basically. Trying to, you know, again, cliques had developed, which is never. I don't like cliques on bases, and Rotherham being that much bigger, of course, cliques had developed, and again, it was trying to bridge these cliques, get people involved in different jobs which they hadn't been doing. Oh, it's his job now, you know. So trying, and again, my technique, if you like, has always been quiet. You know, I don't see the point in just going in and push. There was enough of that had gone on. But we still had to do the programmes, but we needed to talk about it a bit more and get a bit more of a feeling involved and get people involved. And that's what I'd felt hadn't been happening. People were pushed to extremes. And, you know, if you get somebody loading fuel drums for 7 days, 6 days a week, you've got to give them a flight on the seventh day. Get them up in the air, give them a break. And that hadn't been going on. So we tried to do all that. And eventually, we got there, basically.
Were there practical failures in the early years? Were there buildings that leaked or...?
Yes. Well, the big building at Rotherham, I don't quite know how it got there, but there was a huge noise problem. Because, again, the structure was such that originally it was going to be the other way around. He was going to be living upstairs like it's normal and everything downstairs. But because of the structural concerns, it had to be swapped over. So we had the lounge bar, dining room upstairs, bunk rooms underneath. And of course, you can imagine it was just horrendous. The noise was just awful. Eventually, again, we got floating floor in second year, but in that first summer, it was very difficult indeed. It was not ideal. So those sort of type of problems, and of course, problems up at the airstrip, because it was the airstrip. Obviously, we had to get the ramp. We were concerned about the ramp, maybe wearing out, and getting all the depots established properly. And fuel drums, again, we had to pull the fuel drums up, from the point to the strip, and then bring them back down again if we didn't need them. So there was many logistical considerations as well, which didn't help, But it just took organising.
Once you had settled in, the problems didn't really go away, did they? Because you lost two otters, or not you personally, but two otters were lost at Rotherhaw.
I became highly skilled in boxing otters up, basically.
In 1982.
I boxed three up in 4 years, or whatever it was.
What was the story there?
Well, the first one was in the first summer, heavy landing, or heavy takeoff. As she was taking off fully loaded with ferry tanks on, she began to bounce, basically, and then the front oleo went up straight up through the nose and twisted the fuselage, which, of course, led indirectly to the three lads being left behind in Belgrano, because we only had one aircraft then and we couldn't, or the pilot was unwilling, and I can see that, he was unwilling to do a single. Yeah. And also, it was a difficult one because we tried to get the Russians to pick them up and blah, blah, blah. Didn't all happen, they stayed at Belgrano. But then we boxed that otter up because it had never been done before. And we took it apart, boxed it up, put it on the ship and sent it back. And then about, 4 years later, and again, the trouble with the airstrip, it was about 3 miles from the base, and the weather at the airstrip was totally different from the base. So if you got a big wind on the base, it was probably twice as big wind up on the strip or whatever, and it also used to oscillate, it used to change direction. And we had these aircraft up, and we had a fairly bad weather to start, and then we had this huge blow that developed on the base, and we knew that it was like it on the strip. Nothing you can do about it. 3 miles to travel in 80 knots, 100 knots, not even an option, couldn't see anything. During the blow, wind went round 180 degrees. So the aircraft were parked nose to wind, normally not a problem. They fly in the wind, if you like, gone round straight up the tail, boom, just ripped them apart, basically. So again, yeah, we boxed them up and sent them home. But of course, that's devastating because, you have people who are on the base who are supposed to go to Halley and people who are supposed to go out in the field and blah, blah, blah.
What was the Cambridge view of all that?
We should build a hard strip, basically, which had been the talk 5 years earlier. But again, money and building a new base, it was, there were obviously huge implications involved. And it still is. I mean, the snow strip is fine. It is a long way from base. You haven't got that sort of control over it. You can't just get to the strip in 5 minutes. It's not that sort of option. As has proved, the hard strip has been absolutely, if you're going to do essentially 24-hour flying when you need it, you need a hard strip and you need total control over it, which we didn't have.
You've gone to O'Higgins Base in Chile.
Yes.
Which I can't imagine how you ended up there.
This was the aircraft that was crashed. This was the Buffalo, a Canadian test aircraft, a Buffalo, the Avalon 5C. Apparently had flown down to be sold to the Chileans, the background to it. Somehow the pilot had got talked into landing at O'Higgins when it wasn't supposed to. It didn't have skis, didn't even have soft tyres. The wheel had gone through this crust, the prop had hit the crust, and basically the aircraft was abandoned. That was the end of it. So we'd heard about the crash, nothing else. Then, obviously, some accountant sitting in de Havilland's Downsview in Toronto thought, this is about £25 million. What is it still doing in the Antarctic? So someone, presumably de Havilland's and the Canadian government, decided they would rescue this thing, but wanted somebody to lead the team. So they rang Bass, and Dick Laws came in one day. Dave, could you go dance with a bunch of Canadians? And said, yeah, okay, because at that stage it was a highly organised. There were going to be Chilean input, Argentine input. Oh, it was all going to, because we had to take a complete new engine in, all sorts of bits and pieces to rebuild this aircraft. So yes, I said okay. So I led a team of 7 Canadian engineers and a pilot, and we went down to O'Higgins via Chile. Hercules took us in, and then essentially the international backup disappeared. Our only way of getting out of this place was to rebuild this aircraft. There we were in the middle of winter at O'Higgins. Base was superb. They gave us a fantastic support. And we essentially put a new engine on this thing. We dug it out at least 6 times. It got blown apart 6 times. We had this tent from the Canadian Air Force worth $185,000, which was windproof, bombproof. It lasted 5 days. It just got blown to bits. So yeah, we had a challenge, and the thing the whole thing we had to do ended up by putting it on skis, and a Buffalo had never been on skis, so we'd taken down a set of skis from an aircraft called a Caribou, and basically had to bodge this thing to fit. And all this had to be done with a couple of tons of fuel out in the wingtips, because we couldn't take that off, because that was the only fuel we had. Mm. And trying to jack an aircraft up in snow is not the easiest thing. And trying to get it on skis it's never flown on is not the easiest thing. There were many, I mean, the epics were unbelievable. You know, trying to jack up with a little car jack and things like this, and things sinking, and the skis sinking on your wrists. Yeah, super. Anyway, we did it. We got it ready. And of course, then we had the thing, well, what do we do? How do we get this out? And Bill Pullen, who was the pilot, said, well, let's fly it out. And we had no idea how this thing would react on skis. It flew off, it's fine. We got it off and flew it over to Frey, which is the hard strip over on King George Island, and there we had to take the skis off and put the wheels back on for the landing back to South America. Doing that, we broke 2 tyres and damaged the axle. So when we eventually landed at Punta Arenas, we only had 1 tyre on one side, 2 decent ones on the other side, big foam carpet, and Bill landed it on the 2 and kept 1 wheel off and dropped it out. So it took us all winter, basically. I had this wonderful telegram from Paul Whiteman. Please come home soonest. They sent it to us, I'm trying. But it was an incredible effort. It really was. I mean, these mechanics were brilliant. Doug Fleming, who was a prop. I've still got a photograph of him somewhere, because obviously the wires adjust the pitch of the props and everything, and it's done with a highly sophisticated machine. Doug did it sitting on a sledge, with the wires doing it by finger. And he was so accurate that when it got back to Santiago, they couldn't improve on the accuracy of the pitch by the machine. Doug had just done it with his fingers. And we were working in minus 40, 45 every day. It was an epic. But we got it out. We did it. We got it out. And then the Chileans crashed it. They sold it to the Chileans and they crashed it. So. But, yeah, that was an interesting trip.
So this was 1980. Were you by now still on the Bass staff?
Yes, I was still base commander of Rotherham, basically.
So when did you finish going to Rotherham?
I finished the Rotherham year after, in 81, yeah. John Hall took over from me, and then I had a year back in the office, basically, as sort of procurement, if you like.
So you didn't go to Rotherham in the summers of 82, 83?
No.
No, okay.
Sorry. John Hall took over.
Just correcting my notes here.
Yeah, John Hall. And really, I had the year back in the office, and it really wasn't for me, basically. I didn't really want to go back on the stations, but I needed something different. And I actually then went off with the Indians for a while. I helped build the Indian base at Dakshin Gangotri, and then got involved in all sorts of strange projects. Went up to the Arctic quite a lot then. And then in 93, I started with the cruise ships. And these universities doing these programs, and so still very much in the Antarctic even today.
And that was 20 years ago?
Yeah.
20 years this year?
I know.
On the cruise ships, is that a full-time occupation?
Not the cruise ships, but no, I don't work for one company. I mainly work for Hapag-Lloyd. I'm the expedition leader on a couple of their ships, but I do actually, and I'm heavily involved in an organisation called Students on Ice, where we take young people between 14 and 17 to the Arctic and the Antarctic. So I'm involved in those. As I say, I'm involved in these programs in Greenland quite a lot. So still very much polar orientated.
Do you have a day job?
No, not really. I mean, the day job is like next week, if you like. I sit on various committees for IATO, which is the tourist organisation. I'm involved in quite a few polar bodies, as it were. So I suppose that's the day job, is the committee work and the conference work when I'm not south or north, which I can't honestly say I fully enjoy, but not an obligation, that's the wrong word. I feel I have something to give, but I also feel an obligation to support these places that I love. And the only way of supporting them that I can see is to sit on committees, sit on groups, and try and put an input in, basically.
Yeah. We'll come to the touring in a moment. Just let me ask you a bit more about the decision to leave Bass. Mm. What made you decide to stop going to Rothera, and what made you decide? Yeah, what was it that prompted you not to go back to Rothera the following year?
Basically, because I'd done 11 years on the stations then, and it's a young man's game. And I was still young, I was 30, whatever, three or whatever. But I found myself each year saying more and more, oh, you shouldn't do it like we did it like that last year. I thought, this is not, you know, it's a young man's game. They should have their own input. And I felt that I was maybe having a, not a bad influence, but it needed a newer influence.
You were, so effectively you self-centred, you censored yourself.
Yeah, because I felt that I was... it was becoming too much of my image. I'd got into a comfort zone. Things ran really well because that's the way we'd organised it. But I just felt that wasn't the way a base should go forward. It needed newer in blood. It needed a newer input, a different way of doing things. And I just felt that you know, needed change, basically. And the only way I could change it was by leaving. And I must admit, perhaps it was a wrong decision. I went into Bass Logistics, again, because I felt that was a good input, but that really wasn't for me. That wasn't, you know, I wasn't very good at it, and it wasn't the way for me to go forward, basically. And when the Indians offered me this chance, in fact, just here, they built the base at Hereford, with Structiply. And Structiply rang me and said, would I get involved? And they said, yeah, fine. You know, so that was another way ahead, if you like. And I really saw that's quite an exciting challenge.
Yeah. Was Bass a happy place, Cambridge, in the year you were there?
Yes and no.
Changes were in the air, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Very much in the air. It was a bit cliquey, again, which is always something I've always worried about the office. Whatever, I mean, they're not just that sphere. But big changes were in the air, actually, because Bass was expanding rapidly at that stage. And again, health and safety, all these things were beginning to become much more important, if you like. No, I don't think it was that happy a place, actually. There were a few mistakes have been made with Halley 5, and there were all sorts of things going on like that. And I didn't feel... When they offered me the thing at Structiply in India, I didn't hesitate. I just...
So you went from one to the other?
Yeah, I just felt... Well, I'd about 6 months in between. But I just felt this was... Yeah, you know, I didn't actually even think about it, which I'm surprised, because I think maybe if I'd have still been in the middle of the bases, then I probably wouldn't have changed. But I didn't feel that comfortable in the office, and I sometimes felt that we were there and they'd forgotten that we had bases in the Antarctic. You know, that's what we actually existed for. And I find it now when I go back to Bass these days, that's again the feeling I have, is it's them and us, which is really sad. And
did you actually visit the Indian base in situ?
I did, Dakshin, yeah. I did a half, not a winter, I did a sort of half summer, half winter there, because one of their problems, the Indians, is they got a lot of cold weather experience because they've done a huge amount of stuff in the Malaya, of course, but they hadn't actually had a station at that time, and they really wanted the routines, if you like, I mean, we had a few classics. I mean, there was one, the chap called Pavan Ryder, who was their coordinator, rang me, actually, and they were putting new orders in. And he said, could I just pass the orders past you and just double check? Of course, no problem at all. And I looked at this, and they wanted 110 Elsan buckets. I said, we want 110 Elsan buckets. And he didn't answer, and then he rang me back, because obviously he was quite embarrassed about this. And he said, well, we haven't... And the reason was because they hadn't got any untouchables on the base. They were all Brahmins, and nobody would enter the buckets. And so they just ordered 110 buckets so they could have lots of full buckets, nobody emptying them. And I know, it was bizarre. In fact, they got over it by actually employing Tamils. Not because Tamils were of a lower caste, but because Tamils weren't in the class system, so it wasn't a big problem. But because they were all high Brahmins, they wouldn't empty the buckets. You know, it was little things like this, which is just a classic, you know. But no, it was a good time. We had you know.
Was the Herefordshire wooden base successful?
It was hugely successful, actually, and it lasted about twice the length, I think, of what they because then they built a new base at Maitri, which was on a rock outcrop further in, which they did basically, because there was a bit of conflict, not with us, but within the Indian system, because the Indian army wanted to be involved and blah blah blah. So there was quite a lot of conflict inside, and eventually the Indian army got the way that they would do the, which is obviously precluded us, which was fine, it was highly successful. And it was good because we got this system running. And so. And then I got involved with the Pakistanis just after that as well, because they went down with Jinnah. And that there were some classic stories there. I mean, well, the most famous one was, that's how I was living at Morton and Lug. And I got this telex in the morning saying, please order 2 pissing billies. What the hell was a pissing billy? And I sat there all day trying to. And of course, it's like always, you couldn't get back to it, and there was no coming. And what because it was, there was a German tractor called a Kassbuhrer, which is actually a piston bully. And they'd misread it as a pissing billy, because I was, this was sort of 2 incontinent goats or something. You know, could we have 2 pissing billies? You know, what? And so it was things like this. It was just brilliant. Yeah.
Let's talk. We got about 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, sure.
Left. So let's talk a bit about, if we may, your tourism work. How did that opportunity open up for you?
That was the strangest thing. I was actually, I did a lot of work for an organisation called Snow Sled, who makes tents and sledges for everybody, basically, based over in Tetbury. 2 good friends of mine who used to do it, and I always used to help them out building the sledges and so on. Anyway, at that time, there was a German company called Hanseatic who just bought a new ship, and were crewing it and getting organised and going up to the Arctic that summer. It so happened that the person who was there, if you like, logistics organiser, was also the logistics organiser for the German group at the Alfred Wegener Institute. And they were obviously talking, and we were dealing with Alfred Wegener making tents and sledges. And this chap for Hanseatic had been asked, did he know any English-speaking lecturers? Well, of course, the combination that we were dealing with, he said, I'm dealing with a company in Britain now. And I got this phone call at 11 o'clock one night, actually, from this, it's got a classic, will you come on this cruise ship type of thing. And I thought, actually, John Hall, a very good friend of mine, run about an hour earlier, I thought it was him, you know. And I almost said, John, for Christ's sake, shut up, you know. But it wasn't. It was this bloke from the logistics side saying, look, we've got requirement for an English-speaking lecturer on a ship in literally 2 weeks' time called the Hanseatic. Would you be interested?
Going north or south?
This was north. This was in the Arctic. So I said, yeah, sounds great. I've never been on a cruise ship in my life, these adventure cruise ships. So I went, and basically it was a huge success. They said, would I go to the Antarctic with them? That was in 93. I said, yeah, okay. So that was the start of a long connection, basically as a lecturer to start with, and then for the last 12 years I've been the expedition leader.
So what were you having to talk about?
Up in the Arctic, it was basically the Inuit people. Over the years, I'd made a lot of connections with the Inuit, because while I was with Bass, I often used to go north during the summer testing equipment, the aircraft over at Toronto, all sorts of connections with the Arctic. And over those years, I had many, many good friends. So I knew, not knew what I was talking about, I knew quite a lot about the Inuit. So that's what they asked me to talk about, basically, and the Arctic generally. And because when I went there, they said, well, you know, great, do you know anything about the Antarctic? I said, well, yeah, that's where I work. So that was the connection on from there, and I went south with them then. And that's been the, and I do, oh, I don't know, do two or three cruises in the Arctic and four cruises in the Antarctic every year with them, basically. But, as I say, these days, as expedition leader, I sort of run the show, as it were. So.
Well, yeah, okay, so talk a bit more about the responsibilities of the expedition leader then, please. Because the boat runs itself, I guess.
It does. I mean, and we have a highly experienced captain and crew and so on and so forth. Basically, and we also, and I'm involved in, we plan cruises, and those cruises are put into brochures and so on. But then about 2 years after the brochure, we actually do the cruise. So when I join the ship, normally in the south, in Ushuaia, essentially it's up to me to do the day-to-day planning. Obviously, weather, ice, logistics, change the planning around. I know all the landings, you know, more. So I'm able each day, oh, let's go here, or let's do this, let's do that, you know, and able to do the day-to-day planning, coordinate the crew. I run the sort of shore side, if you like. Captain obviously runs the ship. Chief officer runs the Zodiacs, the boats. And then the three of us work together to actually make sure a safe landing, you know, safe for the passengers, get everybody off. And I basically coordinate the whole activity, really, how long we're going to stay there, you know, what we're going to do there. Do we walk? Do we stay? And obviously I have to fit in with the current legislation, which is fairly colossal. Make sure, you know, we do the right thing, if you like. And also make sure the passengers are well aware of health and safety, but also well aware of the sort of ecological responsibilities of where they can't go, what they can't do, what they can't touch, and so on. So it's, yeah, you know.
Is there ever any tension between the expedition leader who wants to give his clients the best possible experience and the captain of the ship who has a different set of priorities?
In the situations the ships I'm on, no, because we've worked together for so long. It's really nice, actually. I mean, it's one of the reasons I stay with Hapag-Lloyd. It's a German company, but I mean, the captains I've known, we've both known for 20-odd years now. It's excellent because they will support me and I will support them. So, I mean, if we're having the captain's having a struggle with the anchor and he'll get on the radio and say, Dave, I think we're going to have to cut this one short. Fine. There's no argument. But equally, if I'm on the shore and there's a monster swell and I say, you know, Tilo, we need to, you know, we're going to have to shut this one down. Fine. There's never a problem. We've got a great working relationship, basically.
How have the clients changed over 20 years?
Actually, a lot. I mean, you've got legions of story about silly tourists. Well, you do get a few, but the majority are excellent. They want to go to the Antarctic or the Arctic. So there's this drive that they want to be there. They pay a colossal amount of money. So I feel an obligation that you have to give them a good deal as possible. The only thing I would say is a change is in their attitude. And that's changed quite recently. Up until about literally 5 or 6 years ago, people were so excited to go to the Antarctic. Now there's more of an attitude of it's my right. I've paid my money, it's my right, you know. But weather's like we missed a day because of bad weather, we shouldn't have done, you know, this sort of thing. There is that subtle change. Whereas in days gone by, people were just literally honoured to be there. People are still excited to be there, don't get me wrong, but there is a feeling that it's my right. I paid my money, but I feel, and I've from what I hear, that's pretty much similar right throughout the all aspects of cruising, if you like. But you know, it's
well, including the med, you mean? Like.
Yeah, it seems to be a sort of modern thing, you know. But you still get people genuinely excited, and I still think tourism is a bonus for the Antarctic because they do act as voice pieces for the place. People go to the Arctic, people come to the Antarctic, they come back and they talk to other people. And at the moment, it's a positive reaction.
Are they better informed than they used to be because of Attenborough and Palin?
Well, right the way through. I mean, much better. I mean, we have a really high-powered lecture team on board, really high quality lectures, so they're fully informed of what goes on.
But have those television series rather stolen some of your thunder?
Not really. It's amazing how many people haven't seen them, to be honest.
All right.
I haven't. I mean, I don't. I have the television. I mean, not because I don't like Arthur. I've got huge respect for him. It's just not my scene, really. And I prefer to see things with my own eyes and be there, you know. And a lot of people are the same, actually. And many people say, oh, it's different from the impression I got. And when you're there, it's the feeling. You're there. And I often tell people, you know, I say, just put your camera down for about 10 minutes. Forget your camera. Use your the best camera you got, which is in your face, and the best computer you got, which is your brain, and sit and listen to the Antarctic, you know, and feel it. And that's the only way. And that, of course, you don't get with the television. You know, it's the feeling of these places. And it's like in the north, you know, an Inuit village. Forget all you've heard of the drunkenness and the thing. Just go and sit with these people. Don't try and tell them. You know, they've lived there for 8,000 years. Mm. Just sit there and try and feel. You know, and I find that quite successful, really.
So, where do people like to go most?
It's an interesting one. Mainly the Antarctic, because of the proximity of the animals. Antarctic Peninsula, you got animals coming out your ears.
So within that Antarctic Peninsula, what are the favourite tourist spots?
There's a variety. I mean, Port Lockroy is probably the most visited because of the base and the shop.
The post box.
Yeah. But I suppose, South Georgia is probably the most popular. And people will pay extra to go to South Georgia. And we often do Falkland, South Georgia, Antarctic, that sort of. And, you know, people never get over standing on Salisbury Plain and places like this and millions of king penguins. And in the Antarctic, places like Paulet Island are hugely popular. Again, where is the quantity of the animals? But what is interesting is that after people have been, the next time they want to see more ice. And our most popular parts of our Antarctic Peninsula cruises are the East Coast, when we go through the Antarctic Sound down the other side of the peninsula, where you haven't got many animals, but you've got ice, lots of.
Are you getting as far south as you used to? Or are you going further south?
We're going further south than we used to. I mean, I spend a lot of time down in Margaret Bay, because I know it so well. But also, there's not that many ships down there. And there's not that many animals, but the scenery is just awesome. You know, and you can get down there more regularly than you used to be able to. But again, you know, despite climate change, if you like, Antarctic ice in the last few years has been really heavy. I mean, this last year, we couldn't get through the Lemaire until late February. You know, so it's not always the change is. The Arctic, of course, has changed massively. You know, that's a different kettle of fish entirely.
What's your view on the rather larger ships? There's some concern about the big ships, which I guess are mainly Japanese
ships. I personally wouldn't work on a ship with more than 200 passengers.
Because?
I don't think you give them the experience. And B, I don't think those size ships should be down there.
Because?
Safety concerns, basically. You know, I mean, small ships have accidents, of course they do. But if you have an accident with 200 passengers, you can do something about it. You know, you can get them safe ashore or whatever. You have an accident with a big ship that's got 2,000 passengers on. It's a totally different kettle of fish. Now, it's got nothing to do with pollution, because the bigger ships are probably actually safer than the smaller ships, because they've got double hulls, they've got all sorts of other, you know. But it's also just the... And also there's the aesthetic side of it as well. You know, a small ship can tend to disappear behind an iceberg. An 85,000-ton ship can't just disappear. And they're there sometimes for the wrong reasons, because they're coming down as part of another part of a cruise because of their speed, whereas they used to go around Buenos Aires, Valparaiso, and now they drop down from Ushuaia because they can do 25 knots. They're down and back in 2 days, you know, whereas it takes us 2 days to get down there. So there's so many different reasons that I feel, you know, could be a problem, basically.
So would people on a big ship perhaps not have the same kind of sense of values about their
holidays? No, because most of them wouldn't land.
They wouldn't.
Most of the ships are not allowed to land at that size. IATA regulations don't allow them to land, so they don't have that connection. They'll see the Antarctic, and that's their argument. Of course, is the fact they're putting less impact. Excuse me. excuse me, less impact because they're not actually landing. But equally, you know, it's just a transient view of the place, really. It's not, they're not feeling Antarctica. I mean, on the small ships, to get ashore, to land on the continent, is all, these are really important aspects. And that's why people come with us. Okay, we're more expensive. But that's why they pay that extra money, because they want to be there. And I mean, the same thing's happened in the Arctic. I mean, ships that go around Greenland, the biggest complaint is, oh, we didn't land. Well, you know, and of course, unfortunately, brochures tend to be a bit like a sort of a, like a novel, really. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Do you ever find yourself on a tourist ship having to do other things? I'm thinking of an incident when you had to bring mail to Sydney one night.
You've been talking to Wyn. Yes, we do. I mean, we support science programs as much as we can. As a German ship, we take down lots of German scientists, for example.
To O'Higgins?
To the Antarctic, to work.
To O'Higgins?
Yeah, yeah. Not to O'Higgins. Well, O'Higgins, yes, there's a what do you call it, a telescope centre there for the European Space Centre. But we also take them to Bellingshausen and other places where there are German installations. And Britain as well. We help quite a lot with Bass sometimes, taking things to South Georgia and whatever. But whenever I'm in Stanley, I will always check with the mail, with the post office, on what basis have or hadn't got mail, or has it been gone, or is it coming soon? And if it turns out they haven't had mail and they've got mail and we're going to that base, then we'll take the mail. I mean, we bring a lot of mail back out for bases, Lochroy, other places as well. But this one at Sydney, we always, because obviously connections with me, if they want mail, because they're very rarely visited, I always take the opportunity. Well, this time I picked up a mail bag. We got to Sydney, and it was quite late in the afternoon, early evening, and it was blowing a hooli. It was 75, 80 knots. It was just hammering. But we thought we'd do it. So we went in very close, and they didn't know we were there. They had no
idea.
With
the big ship?
Yeah, no, this was with the Hanseatic. She's 8,000 tonnes. We tucked in just around the corner because we had to get in close because of this wind. And I went ashore with my assistant expedition leader, who is a gorgeous blonde, Christina Lamper. We got merchant suits on, went down in the Zodiac, and it was a fairly nightmarish trip through the wind and spray. And we landed on the slipway at Sydney. Again, they had no idea we're there. And there was Alan Weird and a few faces at the window, these two strange people from the moon, as it were, landing on their slipway. And we got out. Of course, Christina took her head off, so the great flop of blonde hair, and they couldn't believe their eyes. And I picked the mail bag up, and we walked in and presented with their mail. And they really were lost for words. They were lost for words, didn't we? Because we just appeared from nowhere.
What were they more interested in, the blonde or the mail bag?
I think it was a split decision. But it was a wild, God, it was a wild night. It really was. But no, I like to do it to support the stations. I'll happily take, and we'll take, you know, say, take logistics sometimes, boxes, particularly in South Georgia. And I say we do a lot with the Germans, probably.
You're a big lad, Dave. You play rugby. Mm. Al Smith is an even bigger lad.
Yes, he is.
There is a legendary tug-of-war game at Stanley, in which I gather you both took part.
We did.
Tell me about that, because it's fun, Ali.
We did indeed. God, that was a good grief. Yeah, we used to, again, it's something that Bass is missing out with these years, because they tend to bypass Stanley, and there is not really the sort of Bass connection anymore. But in those days, of course, there was a huge Bass connection. There was the main logistics store. And we were always there for a week or whatever. So we played football, we played whatever was going, rugby and tug of war. And the Marines were often the shall we say, the enemy. and of course, they always thought they were Jack the Lads. But we had some big, because there was Al Smith, there was me, there was the electrician who passed. We were big lads, and we just sort of pulled them straight off the gate, you know. And the Marines, as I say, are always upset about these things, because they always thought they were the kings, as it were.
You were the Chelsea to their Barcelona.
Absolutely, God. Yes, yeah, that was a thing last night. You're right. absolutely. But there were good times, and it's one of the sad things, I think, that aspect has been lost, because Bass has lost their connection with Stanley in a big way, really. And I felt it was quite a lot of the FID's education, if you like, on their way south was to go through Stanley. And it's a bit sad, that.
You say in the base report you wrote for Sydney in 1973, final sentence, My best wishes to everyone staying. Potentially these are the two best years of your life. Make the most of it.
Yeah.
You still feel that way?
I do. Yeah, I do. I still feel as excited. I still get a tingle when I go south, Mel. I still, when I see my first icebergs, I still, all of these years, I mean, this will be, as I say, this is what, 40 years, basically, 41 years, 34 summers and three winters. But I still get as excited now as I did then. It's still amazing. And I still remember that time I went down in October that somebody was paying me to go to the Antarctic. I couldn't believe it. I thought, I didn't even consider that side. But somebody actually paid me to go to the Antarctic. Until today, I go to the Arctic, I go to the Antarctic, and people pay me to do what I want. It's amazing. Yeah, very lucky.
It's been a real pleasure, Dave. Thank you very much
indeed. Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much indeed.